Tonight on The Download, former Chicagoan author Dave Eggers, Tony Award-winning composer from the musical Fun Home, Janine Tesori, and live music in Studio 435 from Chicago's Sunshine Boys. Now, here's your host, a man who is casually interested in kale, Justin Kaufman.
We're dating, Kale and I. Just casually. Just seeing if we like each other. It's leafy. I'll give it that. It's a download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you here till 11 o'clock tonight. 720 WGN. We've got a great show lined up. Wow, Dave Eggers with us tonight. Also, Janine Tesori from the Broadway musical, Tony Award-winning Broadway musical, Fun Home. We'll also have Adam Hoge with our Monday evening quarterback. I am ready for that conversation. With all everything that's happening with the Cubs down 2-0 and now all the city preparing for a seven-game series in the NLCS, the Bears just get a win, and everyone's like, oh, the Bears won. I don't know. I'm not sure if that's a win or not. I know Adam will say he'll say, hey, a win is a win. But I'm not sure I like the direction in which this team is going. Defense played much better. Loved the pick six. Loved the picks, although they were all deflections. There's no one jumping a route. You know, again, they're not ball hawks. They're just kind of, oh, I got it. But at the same time, I don't know. We'll talk about it at 8 o'clock tonight. And also tonight, Studio 435, Sunshine Boys will be here. This is a super band. Jackie Schimmel, Dog Julin, and Frida Love Smith. Frida Love Smith, of course, longtime drummer for the Blake Babies and Antenna. Indie rock legend. Sure, her band, she'll be in here performing. This is the first time she's going to perform with us. Because I had her in a big table one time. She lives in Evanston now. And then the Blake Babies came in. To have her perform? Like, you're in Studio 435 and we have it on, there's different places, but it's awesome to be in the room because it's like it's your own little concert. It's coming at you from all different ways in this little studio on Michigan Avenue. Well, how great is that? I kick my 18, 19-year-old self, pinch him. Can you believe it? Frida Love Smith and the band in studio tonight. So we got a great show lined up. I'm so excited. It's a great show to come back. Great weekend. Hopefully you survived the torrential rain pour. I went to a wedding on Saturday night. Great wedding. Congrats to Val and Sean. But it was in Long Grove, and it was outdoor. It was a tented wedding in the yard. A beautiful tent, formal, the whole thing, you know, like one of those big white, almost circus-type tents. But the whole time we were in there, I was like, this is how I'm going to die. Like, end of days is here. I felt like I was kind of on the Titanic, because it started raining, and you were just like, wow, this just didn't stop all afternoon. We all know it, right? And so the wedding happened, and they exchanged vows. While the vows were going on, the weather stopped. And I was like, yeah, and then it came back. I celebrated. I blame myself for celebrating prematurely. I'll celebrate another vodka soda. And I'm like, what's this? Is it raining again? And then it just didn't stop till like midnight. But it was like, you know, and you're just sitting in there, and kudos to everybody. I mean, imagine the stress of a wedding. I mean, you've been through it, Pete. You know, there's stress involved in the wedding. Now imagine biblical rain. Like, it wasn't even just a normal rainstorm, like, oh, it's gonna rain on my wedding. It's like a nonstop 8 in the morning nonstop rainstorm. Like, there's no, I mean, to persevere through that, high marks, high praise. You know, there's a lot of stress. You could, you know, just in how you're gonna put all that stuff together in an outdoor wedding in a tent with the lights. But I stuck through. I was one of the last ones standing, mostly because I was waiting for my 55 minute Uber to come take me back to the hotel. So Long Grove Uber needs to kind of work it out. I'm used to being in Chicago. I'm like, oh, 3 minutes. I'm like, this one said approximately between and named like a 2.5 hour window. And I'm like, oh, that was unexpected. Well, I guess I'll hang out with you guys. The wedding. They're all super funny. Super funny to be like, so awesome. Thanks for the invite. You mind if I kind of help set up, the take down the chairs or sit on this couch or do something. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun. But amazing to be able to make it through an event like that, a stressful event to begin with all that rain. And when it ended, hey, more power to you. So congrats. All right, news, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. President Trump said he's confident that there can be a bipartisan fix for American health care. This after Trump signed an order to end certain government subsidies to insurance companies and slashing the marketing budget to let Americans know that it's time for enrollment. So he hopes that the Congress will do something to fix what he just did. No, that's crazy. Crazy like a fox territory. I see what you're doing here, President. I mean, I guess if you don't really care if, you know, anyone gets hurt, people in the crossfire, it's a great way to get Congress to act. But what happens if Congress does not do what they are supposed to do? What a concept. What a novel concept. Congress not actually finishing the job? Then what? And everybody's premiums, everybody's, yep, I mean everybody's, goes through the roof. Whose fault's that going to be? I know Obamacare's messed up for a lot of people, but you know what? Have we considered the fact that it might get more messed up? Has anyone thought that maybe we're not at the floor on this one? Sometimes you got to burn it down to build it back up. But that's not a saying, is it? I guess. The president went on to talk smack about Hillary Clinton. No. Pass. No. You realize that in 1, 2, 4, 8 years when Trump is no longer president, you're going to realize that the media is still going to show up to make sure we all know what Trump thinks about everything. Every day, every hour. This is just the beginning, folks. Can't wait for season 2 to start. Woo! Can I give some pro bono advice? I'm not really good at politics, but if you ignored the media's question about Hillary Clinton or even said, you know what, she's irrelevant now, next question, it would be a bigger burn, right, than constantly talking about her. If Trump is truly the schoolyard bully, then constantly talking smack about Hillary means, well, he likes her, right? I think Trump actually likes her. Maybe he's got a crush on her. Because he just won't stop. A top White House economist says that the suggested corporate tax cuts in the reform plan would bring higher wages to workers. So the idea is that if a business didn't have to pay as much in taxes, they'd give you a raise. Yeah, that sounds like no corporation ever in the history of American business. Really? They're going to pass that savings on? All right, good. Sure. I'm looking forward to seeing that press conference when that doesn't happen. There's a Wi-Fi hack that could steal all your private information and even snoop on your emails, texts, and chats. So you mean the NSA? Oh, this is a private sector hack. Sorry. I thought we were still with the public sector. So the fix is just landlines, right? We all ready to go back? Still got yours? Chinese officials say their space station is going to crash to Earth within months. So many made in China jokes here. I don't know where to start, but what are the odds that thing crashes to Earth and kills people, right? Could you imagine how unlucky you'd have to be walking down the street only to be crushed by a runaway space station? That's when you know it's just not your day. In weather, is it safe to come out from the rain bunker? Wow, that was crazy. I think it's the first time in my life where I was like, well, okay, this is it. It's not going to stop. Now what? It's absolutely ridiculous. Remind me to bring it up in my next community meeting. We need a new law or something that says it can only rain for a certain amount of time. It's ridiculous. In sports, the Cubs get a day off to come back home after losing the first two games of the NLCS to the Dodgers. Last night was particularly egregious, in which manager Joe Maddon gave Brian Dunsing and John Lackey the ball. The game tied in the bottom of the ninth. Ugh. Lackey, who may have tied a record for the longest time taken between pitches, gave up a 3-run homer to the ugliest guy in baseball, Justin Turner. Probably even uglier without the beard, let's be honest. Lackey was having all sorts of communication problems with Wilson Contreras, which probably was this. John, you got to throw the fastball. Nah, I don't want to. The minute I throw it, the game's over. No, you got to do it. Nah, I'm gonna take a really long time and throw a bunch of breaking balls in the dirt. I'm going to walk a ton of guys, and then we'll see. Didn't you get that feeling? You got to throw a fastball right now. Nah, I know what's going to happen. And it did. Yeah. Now the Cubs bring the series back to Wrigley. Being down 2-0 isn't the end of the world. One win tomorrow, we're back on track. The Cubs will throw Kyle Hendricks. The Dodgers throw Yu Darvish. Ooh, he'd be an ace on any other team, but beatable. Trust me, fantasy baseball champ. I've beaten you before. Have the Cubs ever faced Darvish before? I don't know. I'm too lazy to look it up, to be honest. The Bears got a big win yesterday, the first of Trubisky's career. It will not be a game that fans will remember because the Bears did everything they possibly could to lose that game to a team that was doing the exact same thing. Awful performance by the Bears special team, who gave up a kick return and a punt return touchdown. Has that ever happened in an NFL game? Again, I'm way too lazy tonight. I'm not looking that up. That's for you to do on your own. That's homework. Google it. Don't even tell me. The Bears coaching staff may have anointed Trubisky the starter, but they're so not into him. He threw the ball 14 times yesterday. Jordan Howard had 36 carries. The Bears found a way to get out of balance the other way, essentially committing to the run. It was very Dick Girani. That's what I'm calling it. Even the trick play. The only good news is that the Bears defense forced some turnovers, got their first interceptions of the season, including a nifty pick six from Adrian Amos. I mean, that's the blueprint, right? Run the ball and score on defense. And we fired Lovey for this. Cool. But back to Trubisky, it's possible the reason he was on the bench is not that he was uncomfortable with the offense, but that the offense was uncomfortable to begin with. They're just like, we don't need a guy who could throw 10 yards. That's not what we do. We just need you to catch the ball from the shotgun. And if it gets over the head, be athletic. That's all we're asking you. I mean, really. I mean, that was 50 carries in that game for 200 yards. No touchdowns. That's a lot of third and fours, right? And finally tonight, Chicago was named by Orkin as the top rattiest city in the country for the third year in a row. I don't know if you know that fact. And can you blame the rats? I mean, the alleys are like four-star prefix menus for these guys. In New York, they got to eat the garbage on the curb for one night. In Chicago, they dine in style, privately, semi-privately. A lot of people back there. That's the carryout for October 16, 2017. Hey, we don't have a rat problem on the carryout. We don't see it as a problem. We see it as an opportunity. Oh, did we tell you that the stew's on? Yeah. Mystery stew. All right, coming up, author Dave Eggers joins us. Talk with him about his Carl Sandburg Literary Award he received last week. Also about his career. 15 years, 826 National. Talk with Dave Eggers on the show, and Adam Hoge joins us at 8 to break down the Bears. It's Download 720 WGN. Stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Well, you've mentioned our good friend Dick Geron a couple of times tonight, so I'd like to dig deep here on the download. He went 35-45 as head coach of the Chicago Bears, caught lightning in a bottle in 2001, 13-3, losing to the Eagles in the NFC division.
They didn't really even show up to that game.
No.
Jim Miller got hurt in that game, remember?
I do.
And he got hurt early, and they were like, he got slammed to the turf. Mm-hmm. Might have been like a Douglas, I forgot the whoever was on the Eagles. Right, but I just remember he trotted out like, he's coming back out of the tunnel, but it was just to come back on the sideline. It was like the most anticlimactic. We're all like, Jim Miller's going to fight. He's going to come out. He's like, no, he's just coming back to join his team. He's not coming back. You're like, Shane Matthews. Okay. Well, that was a fun year.
Yeah. Yeah. All the rest of his other years, he didn't win more than seven games.
Terrible. That year was such a fluke, that 13-3, too. They had a couple of those games where they won on trick plays and weird stuff at the end of the game. It reminded me a lot of yesterday. Imagine that 13 times.
Yeah, we call those gimmick plays in the business, Justin.
So far, I haven't brought up Anthony Thomas. That's who we need to bring up.
That's
a very Anthony Thomas game yesterday.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, this week, the 2017 Carl Sandburg Literary Awards honored some pretty talented writers. The annual awards are usually given to a fiction and nonfiction writer, and they've included names like Eric Larson, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Toni Morrison, and David Mamet, just to name a very small sample size. This year, the awards presented by the Chicago Library Foundation were given to two writers who've worked in both fiction and nonfiction in their careers. Margaret Atwood, who's the author of several works, including The Handmaid's Tale, and former Chicagoan Dave Eggers. Eggers has written more than 10 books, including his memoir, A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius. Eggers is also the founder of the esteemed literary magazine McSweeney's and 826 National, which is a series of literary organizations in cities across the country, including right here in Chicago, 826 Shy and the Secret Agency Supply Company, both located in Wicker Park right there in Milwaukee. The literary organization started in San Francisco 15 years ago. Eggers has contributed mightily to pop culture with his writings and his various projects, including his latest book, Ungrateful Mammals. He was just honored with the Carl Sandburg Literary Award, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the download Dave Eggers. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Growing up here in Chicago, in Lake Forest, what's it mean to get this award, to get the Carl Sandburg Literary Award?
Well, it's sort of beyond my imagining. Carl Sandburg looms large in anyone's mind, especially if you grow up in Illinois, but if you grow up in the U.S., you know, I think there's Walt Whitman, and then there's Carl Sandburg in terms of really, I think, singing the American song. You know, it's of that era especially. And then since then, we've had all kinds of voices, but I think those two guys are neck and neck in terms of their lyricism and sort of how they full-throated kind of way that they express the story of our country. So it means everything to be mentioned in that conversation and also to be able to hang with Margaret Atwood, who is one of my favorite authors and favorite people. She's hysterically funny.
You know, for the literary awards, to be able to get this, especially being from Chicago, and you think about all the writers that have come from this area, what have you learned from your writings based on who's come before you in this town?
Well, I grew up in Lake Forest and spent a lot of time in Chicago, as anybody would, and went to the University of Illinois downstate. And I identify myself as a Midwesterner and as an Illinoisan and take great pride, right? Not just Lincoln and Sandburg, but Saul Bellow and Studs Terkel and Gwendolyn Brooks. And I was just at the American Writers Museum down on Michigan Avenue, and it's incredible when you can see all the writers who have come from the area. I'm heading out to Oak Park now, and I'll go by the Hemingway House, and it's just sort of stunning. But I love that museum is located in the heart of Chicago, because Chicago is the middle of the middle and the heart of the heart, so it's where it belongs.
Dave, for you and your career, and like I said, usually they'll do someone who's done fiction and someone's done nonfiction. You've done both, so has Margaret. Talk about how you've diversified in terms of your platform. You've written and produced, really, in several genres. It hasn't just been memoir. It hasn't been just novel. You've done so many different things, including children's book just recently and the illustrations that are in Ungrateful Mammals. Is that important for you to change it up, to challenge yourself, to try different platforms and different genres as a writer?
Yeah. I mean, that's it. You said it. It's I get not just antsy, but I'm to get up in the morning, you have to be learning something. And to do the, either it's you're learning a new subject matter. I just wrote a book about the history of coffee in Yemen. And that was 3 years of research into coffee and cultivation and, you know, the history of coffee in America and in Yemen. And that's what gets you up in the morning, I think, to learn. And I studied journalism at the University of Illinois, and I just got hooked on the idea of journalism giving you access or giving you an excuse to ask questions and to learn something new every day and have a wide body of knowledge, even if it's temporary and shallow in some cases, where you do a story and you move on, but you try to do it right. And I gravitate toward that, things where I can start from scratch and learn something new. And I think every story has its right form, whether it's a picture book or whether it's nonfiction, fiction, poem, oral history. I think that there's a right form for that particular story, and I try to have the humility to follow what the story demands.
When you think about the idea, like talking about coffee in Yemen, how much effort do you put into not just finding the idea, but like you just said, the treatment of that idea, what discipline, what genre? Is there a process, not unlike writing, that goes into how you're going to treat the idea?
Yeah. I mean, that's the research is one thing, and then finding what form you're going to tell it in is the other thing. So I was working with a young man named Mokhtar Al-Khanshali, who's a Yemeni-American friend of mine from San Francisco, and I interviewed him for 2 odd years before I knew what form it would be, how to structure the book. So the research is one thing, and then somewhere deep in the process, you arrive at the right form, mm-hmm. and then it all comes together. But that can take years, to feel like you did it right and that you've matched the story with the form, whether it's first person, third person, second person, fiction, nonfiction. When you know it, but yeah. And you also know when you haven't gotten there yet, it's not ready. So you put it back in the oven.
That's been a hallmark of your career. Stunning writing, is of course, but the way that it's presented, even with heartbreaking work of staggering genius. When you say that you don't know, you got to put it back in the oven. Are there times that you'll go down a certain path where you're writing maybe the Statue of Liberty book, or maybe that's not a good example because it's a children's book, but where you're writing something or you're presenting something or doing something with McSweeney, whatever it is, that you go, you know what? This isn't working. I'd rather go in this direction.
All the time, and almost without exception. It's never easy. Well, I guess the Statue of Liberty book was the second picture book I did, and I think I knew what I was doing in that case. But usually it's a reinvention every time. And almost without exception, it's trial and error, and you go down a lot of blind alleys before you find the right path. And, at 826, that's what we teach the kids, too, is that I'm 47. I've been doing this for 25 years, and I still don't know how it's going to turn out anytime I start something new and whether it will work out. And it's usually the 16th version that becomes the right one. And I think once you teach kids, and especially reluctant writers or a kid that doesn't think he is a quote-unquote good writer, that it's a process for all of us, and that we're always learning and we're always revising. And if you approach it with humility and attention to the process, then anybody can get there. You can make effective, competent writers out of any student if they're willing to put the work in.
I think about trust being a big part of it, trusting yourself, trusting your voice, because if you are going down a certain road and I think about and it's not working out and you've put a lot of time and effort into one thing and you want to try something else, but it might be a little bit closer to the cliff than your usual comfort zone, it really is about humility and trusting your voice.
Well, I think that's what you, at least I took away from working in newspapers and working in, and then my professors at U of I and in the J School, and discipline and humility. And it's not something that's always first and foremost in your mind. I think if you're going to grad school and getting an MFA, I think that's why I think journalism and at least a few classes in journalism or a few year or two in newspapers, I think is good for everybody, because you get a little bit less precious about yourself. You take the work just as seriously, but I think that you take it on as a cultural worker, in that role, as opposed to thinking of yourself as a precious little butterfly or something like that. You roll up your sleeves, you do the work. If it's not right, you do it again, take more feedback, get edited brutally, take it over, take it back. But I think it's necessary, and I think that all of us that came through that path, newspapers and go back to Orwell and Hemingway and all these other guys that started that way, and Joan Didion, who did all kinds of journalism. I think that there's something common to all those writers and all of us that have been flattened by a tough edit or 100 tough edits, but you come fighting back and you reinstate your style, but your work is always stronger for having been examined word by word.
The last question is about 826. 826 celebrating 15 years since the first store that was in San Francisco and the first organization. It's amazing to think that 826 and 826 National, there's so much that goes into that work and helping with literacy and kids, but also the stores, the Boring Store here in Chicago, now the Secret Agency Supply Company, the store in Brooklyn is amazing. What's it mean to you to be celebrating this anniversary 15 years ago? How's it feel?
It's the definition of growing organically. There was no plan outside of one neighborhood center in the Mission District of San Francisco. And then friends of mine here and friends in Brooklyn and friends in LA said, we'd like to adapt the idea and bring it here. And So it was always from the ground up, always community-based, always local buy-in, local funding, local, you know, management. They're all their own 501c3s. So at a national level, we sort of encourage them and urge them on and help when we can. And I come in and do fundraising. Otherwise, I stay out of the way and I let them serve their communities the way that they know best. And, but you know, there's 7 cities in the U.S., 2 more to come in New Orleans and Minneapolis. And then there's 42 other centers around the world based on the model. So this summer I went to Stockholm and there was a center there that is a carbon copy of 826. And they were inspired by our centers and they built their own version of it there. Same programming, same spirit, same sense of welcome above all, making sure that especially kids who are new arrivals, their families are new to these countries, whether it's Sweden or here, feel welcome and heard and listened to and valued, and we can polish their work and amplify it. It's the same thing. So it's in Sweden and Santiago and Melbourne, Toronto. They're all over the place, and I think that they all share that same sense that kids need to be heard and they need to have a permission and a safe haven to write and to have their work looked at and shown a light on. And in May, we're going to have the first International Congress of Youth Voices, which will take representatives from every one of these cities, and they'll gather in San Francisco to share ideas, but also have a public event where they speak to the issues of the day and make sure the teenagers who are going to be most affected by the policies of here, whether it's U.S. or any other country, the teen voices about what affects them and what will affect them are heard, yeah. Whether it's climate change or North Korea. They need to have a seat at the table and a voice that's heard.
My guest tonight, Dave Eggers, best-selling author who just won the Carl Sandburg Literary Award here in Chicago for his great career. We were just talking as well about 826 National, 826 celebrating its 15-year anniversary. Dave, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out tonight to talk to us on the download.
Thank
Appreciate
you
it.
So much. It's really, really good to talk to you.
All right, coming up, Adam Hoge's going to join us. Talk about the Chicago Bears, our Monday evening quarterback segment, 312-981-7200. Are you like me? If you listen to the show, you know I love the Bears. I'm a Chicagoan, and I like the Bears, issues in the NFL notwithstanding. But I like to see them win, and I'd like to see them be competitive, and we're jonesing for it. We're passionate for it. But are you like me that yesterday was just not – it was unacceptable? Yes, it's a win. I love that the Bears are 2-4. But it almost feels like they won in spite of themselves. A game in which they finally got great contributions from their defense. The offense just kind of chewed on itself for a whole game. It just didn't want to win, didn't want to – it just did nothing. Trick play here, whatever. So let's talk about it. 312-981-7200, Adam Hoge coming up here. I'm fascinated to see because I also would love to ask about the defense. Did we just see the missing ingredient? If the Chicago Bears become ball hawks and start picking the ball off, will they take a defense that's good and become great? They have the players. They just have been missing him closer and closer to the football. And yesterday you saw a defense that was much more reminiscent of a Chicago Bears defense that we've known for the last 2 decades, whether it be one under Dick Geron or Lovie Smith or whatever it was. The hallmark was score on defense. So we'll talk about that because they got it done, and they ended up winning the game for the Bears, even though Jordan Howard had, what, 36 carries? 36 carries in a modern NFL game. Like I said, I'm too lazy to look up where that stands, but wow. All right, so Adam Hoge coming up. After that, Janine Tesori is going to join us. A Tony Award-winning composer. Fun Home, Shrek the Musical, Thoroughly Modern Millie. There are a ton of credits to her name on Broadway, and she will be my guest coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then, of course, I mean, Sunshine Boys in studio. Frieda Love Smith. How great is that? One of my favorite musicians of all time in studio playing tonight on the download. I couldn't be more excited for the show.
From 40 yards out, and the Bears win it. The Chicago Bears come into Baltimore, and Mitchell Trubisky, their quarterback, has won his first game in the NFL.
There we go. Nice to play that song. We actually win a game. It's Monday evening quarterback time. The Chicago Bears beat up, beat the Baltimore Ravens 27-24 yesterday. Was it it's nice to be in the win column, no doubt about it. Was it something that, if you're like me, you still have questions and scratch your head about some of the choices that were made by this Bears coaching staff, especially the offense, as they put the ball in the hands of Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen 50 times, 50 carries. At the end of the game, Mitch Trubisky threw the ball 16 times. That included overtime. On the line with us, okay, Adam Hoge from WGN Radio. He covers the Bears. You can get all his stuff, his great stuff, including the podcast, WGNradio.com/Bears. Joins us every Monday night to rehash 312-981-7200. Mr. Hoge, how are you?
I'm good, Justin. Bears get a win. And had I known that all I had to do was bring you those horrible interception stats,
right,
that would turn everything around to start getting interceptions, I would have done that back in training camp.
That's right. Last week, we honed in on that, the idea that they had not had an interception. And frankly, they had the worst turnover ratio in the NFL. And they had since 2012, they have just... You've seen them drop off a cliff when it comes down to how many turnovers they're getting per game.
Yeah, and they had 16 interceptions since the start of the 2015 season, which was when John Fox took over, which was dead last in the entire NFL. The Cowboys are the next closest team with 19. That was going into this week. So for them to grab those interceptions yesterday and score on one too, which is what Lovie Smith used to always say, you know, don't just get the takeaway, but score on the takeaway. That was the goal every week, and we saw it happen, you know, a lot in his tenure. And since he left, the last five seasons have been rough in that regard.
Adam, I have a lot of questions about the offensive side of the ball, especially when it comes to balance. And I want to get into that, and I've been kind of grousing about that in the last hour. I don't want to get to that, but I think it's fair and in a positive spin to talk about the defense first, because we always do the defense last. But yesterday we started to see why this defense, you know, why there's been so much said about this defense and they could be great. You saw with the turnovers, they turned into a different type of team. They harassed Joe Flacco and the Baltimore Ravens all day.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen so far this season is a good defense. And, you know, I've said this to you guys, especially up front. The front seven's pretty good. I think that their outside linebackers, they could probably upgrade that position a little bit more in this offseason, but they're not bad. They're getting enough production. Leonard Floyd is actually getting better. I know the sack numbers aren't piling up, but I marked down at least four or five very obvious pressures that he put on Joe Flacco yesterday. So, I mean, there's progress being made there, and as long as you have Eddie Goldman and Akeem Hicks healthy on that defensive line, they're, you know, I think the Bears are going to have a chance to win football games. But the difference between a good and a great defense is you can rank highly in yards per play and in yards per game and all that, but if you don't take the ball away, you're not a great defense. Great defenses have to take the ball away, and that's what this Bears defense was not doing. Yesterday, they came away with three takeaways, scored on one. They were all huge plays. The Bears don't win that game without those takeaways, especially, and I know we're going to get into this in this hour, all the mistakes they made. This defense bailed the offense out, bailed the special teams out throughout this game. They came up with the big plays, and the secondary finally took a step forward. It was very impressive.
Kyle Fuller, let's start there. A guy much maligned in his Chicago Bear career, came in as a number one pick last year, didn't play at all with a knee injury, we talked about it, even in camp, there were talks of him not even making the team. He was going to be the odd man out. He has stepped up with the absence of Marcus Cooper. Yesterday, it seemed like Joe Flacco had a game plan to go at Kyle Fuller, but he played tremendous.
Yeah, well, and even going into this game, it showed you how the Bears feel about him and how much he's come along since the offseason with Marcus Cooper being healthy. I mean, he missed the last game with a back problem. But he was healthy and active in this game, but he barely played.
Wow.
Kyle Fuller has taken over that starting job, and he's not giving it up right now. Look, the Ravens' wide receivers are not very good, but he was stuck like super glue to those guys throughout the game. The only play where I thought he lost his guy and actually got beat was that play where Breshad Perriman, who was the Ravens' best wide receiver, actually got knocked out of the game with a concussion when Eddie Jackson came over and hit him, and that created the first interception for Bryce Callahan. That was really the only time.
Yeah,
all
he
game
didn't
I thought,
turn his head around quick enough, but it worked out.
Right, yeah, and you got, you know, you got, but that's, you know, that's a sign of a good secondary though. Corner gets beat, the safety gets over there and knocks the ball loose. Fortunately, he suffered a concussion on that play, and it was actually a very scary hit.
Yeah,
but I think it was also a legal hit. I think it was just an awkward hit, and that's, you know, a young secondary right now is playing well in that regard. And Kyle Fuller is a very interesting situation here because the Bears could have picked up his fifth-year option in the offseason. Okay, the deadline to do that was this past offseason. They did not do that. Obviously, they didn't do that because he looked like a bust. We didn't really think he was even going to be around this year. So you can't look back on that and say it was the wrong decision. I think it was the right decision. But now it creates a very interesting situation because he's playing very well right now, like a guy who's going to hit the free agency market in the offseason and make a lot of money. So it'll be interesting to see what the Bears do with Kyle Fuller here. Do they try to extend him? Do they, you know, where does this go? Because right now he's looking like a guy you actually want to keep around here.
The first time, I think, this entire year that we have actually seen call after call on the defensive side where stars are emerging. Danny Trevathan played a tremendous game where he was missed the week before because of suspension, but you saw him making plays. Eddie Jackson from the safety position came up and made a huge open field tackle at one point. The nonstop Eddie Goldman and Akeem Hicks over and over, Pernell McPhee and Leonard Floyd. It seemed like this defense was feeding off each other's energy because it seemed like every other play that was made by the defense was another guy that you're like, oh, they got that guy too.
Yeah, I mean, in this game, they had playmakers at every level of the defense. Up front, you know, Akeem Hicks has been, I've been saying this every week, he's playing like an all-pro. He should be an all-pro if the season ended today. It doesn't, you know, a lot of season left, but he's playing like a pro bowler, and he deserves all those accolades and really playing up to that extension he signed at the start of the season, which is great to see when you invest money in a guy like that, and he continues to perform. But Eddie Goldman right next to him, you know, this was a guy who's battled some injuries, and we kept saying, you know, if he can stay healthy, you can see the signs that he is going to just be a huge difference maker on that defensive line. And he has been that this season.
Yeah.
Doesn't necessarily pile up all the numbers, but if you watch the tape, he is clogging up the middle, pulling in double teams, and that's freeing up space for Akeem Hicks and other guys to get to the quarterback. And it's been very impressive. And it's completely different when in terms of shutting down the run game when Eddie Goldman's on the field. Then you go to the next level. You mentioned Danny Trevathan. We saw the difference last week when Trevathan wasn't on the field. He was missed, right? Some of those linebackers didn't, you know, Christian Jones didn't look as good last week as he did yesterday. And I give him credit, too, for stepping up. But Danny Trevathan was flying around the field against the Packers a few weeks ago, gets suspended. They missed him against the Vikings. He had another great game yesterday. And then we just talked about the playmakers in the secondary that are starting to emerge. So when you could have when you can have difference makers at every level of your defense like that, it makes a huge difference.
All right, here's what we'll do. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. 312-981-7200. We talk about the good. Let's talk about the offense. That's next here on the Monday evening quarterback. Adam Hoge joins us. He takes your questions, calls. I already got some texts about, which I think is a nice little teaser here. The 815 says, the Bears know how to lose. And I think that we can get into that because it seems like at every game that we have the commanding lead, something happens in which we get closer to having that snatched from us. It almost happened yesterday. The Bears almost lost that game. They won it actually by accident. So we'll talk with Adam Hoge here. Coming up here after the break, Monday evening quarterback. Stay with us.
Flacco fakes, rolls, looks downfield, and throws. It's intercepted by Amos. Adrian Amos on the pickoff and the return. Amos still going, has a couple blockers. He's got a chance to go all the way. Adrian Amos, touchdown Bears.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. The Chicago Bears with the victory. It's Monday evening. Quarterback 312-981-7200 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Adam Hoge with us. Of course, the man covers the Bears for WGN Radio, wgnradio.com/Bears. All right, so I just want to read these stats. I mean, let me start here, Adam, because I got a lot of texts about this as well. What was the game plan for the Chicago Bears in this offensively? Did they see something with the Baltimore Ravens defense that said they could be taken advantage of on the ground? What was the approach and the reason why the Bears put the ball in the running back's hand 50 times yesterday?
Yeah, you know, John Fox after the game referenced the time he played the Ravens with the Broncos when he was the head coach of the Broncos and had Peyton Manning. And they did something similar where even though they had Peyton Manning, they ran the ball, you know, 40-some-odd times in the game. Now, I think this is a little bit of a different situation where I think there's a number of factors. I think one is probably the matchup. They saw something that going into this, they thought that they would definitely run heavy compared to passing the ball. I think part of that also has to do with the lack of wide receivers that that Mitch Trubisky has. And remember, Tanner Gentry got promoted to the active roster and was starting. I don't think that was the plan early in the week when they promoted him. I think they still thought they were going to have Marcus Wheaton out there, but Wheaton tore his groin in the middle of the week. So Gentry gets thrown out there. And if you saw, a lot of times they brought those wide receivers in a huge bunch formation, and that was kind of the game plan the entire day. So I think part of that had to do with personnel, the matchup against the Ravens, and then also Mitch Trubisky said after the game that it had to do with how they were playing him even within the game. The safeties were back, which had surprised them, and they felt like they could run. And they did run the ball pretty well yesterday.
Yeah.
Wasn't always consistent, but they were able to do that. So
yeah, I guess I would push back a little bit because
okay.
if Jordan Howard doesn't rattle off that 50-yarder in overtime, I'm not sure that you could say that the Bears ran the ball well.
Yeah, he would have been below 4 yards per carry.
He would have been barely over 100, maybe 110 yards with 36 carries, 35 carries. When you look at the stat lines of all the other running backs in the NFL, they're carrying the ball 25 times, scoring 115, 120 yards. The Bears, yes, they committed to the run and they got the victory and they got the time of possession, all that. But that's not why they won. None of those running backs got in the end zone. And they had to win with trick plays and a pick six. I mean, you know, it's not as if the running game was actually effective. If anything, it kept the Ravens in the game.
But I made reference to this in the middle of the game. Everyone was frustrated. Trust me, my Twitter timeline was filling up with everyone was mad at Dow Loggins' play calling. So let me clear one thing up. I don't think that's Dow Loggins. I think that is all John Fox's philosophy and how he wants to run this thing right now. And especially when they have the lead in a game like they did. And really, they were in control for three quarters yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think it was in the middle of the third quarter, and everyone was frustrated with the play calling. But I tweeted out, as long as the Bears have the lead in this game, I don't expect this to change because it's not pretty. It's quite frankly kind of ugly, and it's boring, and it didn't look that great. But guess what? The Bears had a lead. And they were in control of the game, so I didn't expect John Fox to get away from it. So that's kind of why they continued to do that philosophy throughout the game. But I also think it goes back to part of this is they did not plan on playing Mitch Trubisky this early in the season. And I think that they are trying to develop him very, very carefully and not throw too much at him right now, especially when you consider the lack of weapons he has a wide receiver.
I'll buy the wide receiver issue. They have tight ends and they have running backs. And we saw Mike Glennon with the same, you know, crappy wide receiver unit check down every third play or second or first play. But to me, I just was frustrated as a fan because there are other rookie quarterbacks first time starting that are throwing the ball 30, 35 times a game. You look at Deshaun Watson or you look at even the backups that are getting their first shot, whether it be in San Francisco or whether it be in Cleveland. They're not changing the game plan. The idea that Mitch Trubisky, who's your number two overall, is only in the game plan to throw 16 passes. I mean, really, when you look at it, I think Cam Newton threw it 52 times. I mean, the idea that they're that far off, there's something as a fan which is it's just out of balance. I mean, we always hear balance like when you talk about they throw the ball too much, but in this case, I felt like they ran the ball too much.
Well, and again, I think a lot of it has had to do with the fact that they jumped out to a lead. I think it would have been different had they fallen behind, and that really is crucial because they've been playing from behind way too much. And also, I mean, Deshaun Watson has DeAndre Hopkins to throw the football to, and that makes a huge difference. You can just lob the ball up to that guy, and the worst-case scenario is it's going to be incomplete because he's going to knock it down. And there's nobody, nobody that resembles that play.
Even on a training camp, there's nobody. Let's be honest.
There really wasn't.
No. All right. Well, I'll keep on this only because, and we'll take a break and get an update from Rob. It's interesting to me that the fans had clamored for a Mitch Trubisky. The change was made, and what we got yesterday was a John Fox special in which they wanted to win ugly. And when you have Mitch Trubisky, who's not Shane Matthews, and he's not name any of the 30 quarterbacks that's not Jay Cutler, Kyle Orton or whatever.
Todd Collins,
right. You would just assume that there would be more opportunity to test this kid out. And yesterday, they might as well have played Mike Lennon. I'm going to take and leave it there. We'll come back. We'll continue. Adam Hoge, WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com/Bears. You can find out all his stuff, including a great podcast he does with Adam Johns. We will continue the conversation here. Monday evening quarterback, 312-981-7200. Did the Bears Dick Geron this game? Stay with us.
Third and seven. Trubisky being rushed. Throws to the end zone for Deion Sims. He's got it for a touchdown.
Thanks, Rob. It's the Monday evening quarterback here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Adam Hoge joins me from WGN Radio, covers the Bears. You can find out all his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears and hear him throughout the week and, of course, on the beat Saturdays. All right. I promised, 708 said, you're complaining too much about a win. And I find myself doing that. I think the positives, even though Mitch Trubisky only threw the ball 16 times, there were a few plays that showed why Mitch Trubisky's in the game and not Mike Glennon. First, let's talk about, again, with the offensive line center. Whitehair is just not I don't know what's going on with Cody. Is it Cody?
Yeah, Cody Whitehair.
Yeah, he snaps it over his head, but Mitch Trubisky shows his athleticism. This is the startling difference between a Trubisky and a Mike Glennon.
Yeah, I had four plays, and when I went back and watched the game over today, I came away even more impressed with Trubisky's performance than I thought. And I thought he played great. And I said on the podcast yesterday, our postgame podcast, that they don't win the game without Mitch Trubisky, and that's kind of what you're getting at, Justin. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at I'll mention all four plays. First of all, earlier in the game, there's a third and four, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Third and medium range, where he scrambles outside to the left side, sees an opening, and just goes and runs for it, and then is able to pick up even more yardage, and then ends up sliding down near the 10-yard line, and that set up a field goal. That's not only a smart play, but also a play that not all quarterbacks can do. His mobility allows him to do that. Okay, then the touchdown throw that he had, Kyle Long just completely missed his block on that play.
Yeah.
I saw some people criticizing Trubisky for not seeing Deion Sims open earlier, and he was uncovered. It was some kind of busted coverage by the Ravens, and so maybe Peyton Manning is able to see that before the snap or something like that, okay? But Sims wasn't his first read on the play, and his right guard allowed pressure immediately right after the snap, so he's able to roll out to his right, avoid the pressure, and still find Deion Sims. I had no problem or any criticism with what Trubisky did on that play. I thought it was a great play. And then you talk about that recovery in the end zone. Absolutely. That's probably a touchdown for the Ravens if Mike Lennon's the quarterback. Forget safety. They probably recover the fumble and get a touchdown out of it. And then obviously the pass in overtime to set up the game-winning field goal. The way he stepped up in the pocket, that footwork in the pocket is what I've been raving about since the night they drafted him. That's the stuff that showed up on his North Carolina tape that you just can't teach. His feel for pressure, stepping up, and then kind of throwing like almost a jump pass, and it was on the money. Kendall Wright made a great catch.
It's amazing that, of course, Kendall Wright's going to get that third down. We'll remember that play, but watching Mitch Trubisky evade the rush, move his body, and still keep his eyes downfield, I mean, that's what you bring to the table. And I think the reason that I at all complain about the Bears' victory is I want to see more of that. Yeah. I want to see both the positives and negatives. I want to see him throw an interception. I know I don't want him to lose, of course, but I want to see him go through that progression, understand, like, be in those situations again. Is there anything to be said about the way that the Bears lost against the Vikings on Monday night, where it was more of a gunslinging way that they lost, where Harrison Smith got that interception, that made John Fox and Dow Loggins rethink the game plan for Mitch Trubisky moving forward?
Well, I think that's kind of what I was getting at in the last segment. I don't know that this game plays out as conservatively. It would have been conservative, no question. They came out conservative. But it, like, went ultra-conservative. And I think that's what you're frustrated with. I think that's what fans are frustrated with, because they're all seeing this exciting new quarterback, young, has all these tools, seems to have the awareness and the playmaking ability that no other Bears quarterback has had in a long time. And they want to see more of it. And I get it. I get it, especially because it's been so hard to watch this team over the last few seasons. It has been really, really hard to watch them and devote a full Sunday to them every single week. And I get it,
right?
Because Trubisky has that excitement and looks like he's going to be good, so you want to see that. But I think when you see that interception that he threw last week against the Vikings late in the game, you still understand that he's young. And it is important for John Fox to still win football games if he wants to keep his job. So in a situation like yesterday, I think that's why it went from conservative to ultra-conservative, because once they had that lead, once they were protecting a lead, as ugly as it was, as boring as it was, they did not want to create a crucial mistake. And now here's the thing. They ended up doing that, and it wasn't Trubisky's fault.
Right.
It was a bunch of other guys.
Special
he did
teams,
have the fumble,
right.
But that was – well, I guess if he didn't identify the protection correctly, because a blitzer did run free on,
who,
on his fumble.
I was going to ask you that question, because on that play, and also the very strange hurry-up third down play that it felt like they were trying to get the Ravens to be offside. And that came mm-hmm. that play busted up because no one read the coverage and didn't recognize that the guy was coming. That it might even ended up in a turnover. But whatever, and that play, that was a crucial play. Who is calling protection for the Bears offense? Is it Trubisky? Is it the offensive line? Who's missing? Because every time Trubisky got hit yesterday and any sort of the fumble or any other sack, they were pretty much coming clean.
Yeah, I mean, and that is one thing that we're probably not gonna ever know. I mean, that's the one thing, as I look at the film every week, that's the thing I'm guessing on. I can't grade it all out accurately, and I make that clear when I talk about how I grade the film. I mean, I don't know the playbook. I don't know, you know, who's got every single responsibility. I do my best during the week to ask those questions off to the side and try to find out, not in the interest of, you know, telling the world who screwed up, but really just to accurately understand who's struggling with what. And that is a fair point to bring up, Justin. It's a great question, because that's a lot of that is on the quarterback. Now, usually the center has something to do with it. And, you know, when you have a smart veteran guard like Josh Sitton, he might chime in too on identifying the mic, which means, you know, which all that means is identifying the point of how the protection is setting up. So when you do see a blitzer come free, like we saw on Trubisky's fumble, which was a turnover early in the fourth quarter, it's possible that that was a mistake made by Mitch Trubisky. He maybe did not see the blitz, and maybe that's on him. Or, you know, sometimes it's just great defense.
Yeah.
And you give a defensive coordinator credit for beating the offensive coordinator. That happens throughout a game.
Yeah.
So that's always kind of hard to know. But those are the things that just come with experience and kind of supports what I've been saying, like, yeah, look boring, but just hand the ball off sometimes, and you can avoid that, because I think those are the things they're not quite fully comfortable with Mitch Trubisky going through a full game without having those types of mistakes. Yet.
Well, those mistakes that were made were important at different times, because the Bears were almost always in a third and mid to long because the running game was not picking up more than 2 yards a carry. I mean, that was that you found that more often than not they were a third and six to third and ten, and we saw that in the Vikings game as well. What I did like this time around was Mitch Trubisky, and it's not fun. Again, it goes to that ultra-conservative game plan. He was much more disciplined to get that ball and throw it out of bounds when it wasn't there for him. I saw him do that 3, 4, 5 more times than he did against Minnesota, not trying to force something in. I think that's great. I think that's great coaching. I also think the greats might still buy some time and look for a third option.
Right, but I think that's something they're coaching Trubisky to do right now, you know, until he earns that ability to make
right.
the types of
that's
chances.
That's where fans
that,
are getting frustrated because we're like, that's what you're teaching this guy to throw it away? You know, that's my point. But go ahead.
It's something that you develop over time. I mean, Aaron Rodgers has earned the credibility to make a tough throw instead of throwing it away. And he still does throw it away sometimes.
Yeah, right.
The six throwaways yesterday. John Fox was actually raving today about those throwaways by Mitch Trubisky. And it almost sounded like an unintentional shot at Mike Glennon, but he said six throwaways better than six interceptions.
Right. That's my point. That and I 815's got a good point on this, the text. They said it doesn't seem like the offense has fire in their eyes playing the coach's game plan. And I don't know anything about what fire is in any sort of running back or wide receiver or quarterbacks, but it did feel, like you said, very ultra conservative. And when the coach is going out of his way to say positive things about throwaways and you didn't screw up, you didn't actually make the play, but you didn't screw up. I just feel like it's a very weird psychological thing for a Bears team that we want to see open it up. You see what I'm saying there? That's the point I have. That's why I've had came up with a sour taste for this win.
I do. I just think you need to be careful about bringing Mitch along the right way.
Yeah.
And you want him to gain confidence slowly. And if you can do it in a conservative way where he still manages to get a victory, that's a great situation. And again, I'll go back to the fact that this should have been an easy win for the Bears. Even as conservative and as boring as it was offensively, they were in control for three quarters. And I was thinking midway through the third quarter, when's the last time the Bears had
right.
a game where they whooped the team from start to finish? And that looked like what was going to happen. And then they made the mistakes. Tariq Cohen fumbles. The two special teams returns that they give up, and there was a bad punt in there too, and Jordan Howard's running out of bounds when the clock should have been running out. I mean, these were really stupid mistakes that they made.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't have been that
hard. Hand it away, right.
So.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, you've walked me back, Adam.
Let's just see how – I think every week it's going to get a little – they're going to allow him to do a little bit more. And yeah. if that game had been tighter, I think you would have seen Mitch – throw the ball more.
Yeah.
And the one thing that's not going to change is that we're just going to have to live with this season. He doesn't really have anyone to throw the ball to.
Yeah. 312-981-7200. We'll read some of the texts and wrap up with Adam Hoge here on the Monday Evening Quarterback right after this. Stay with us.
Blitz coming. Trubisky steps up, throws, and the catch is made. Kendall Wright, leaping grab inside the 25-yard line.
Right, yes, we will remember those highlights. The Chicago Bears with the win. Monday Evening Quarterback, Adam Hoge, covers the Bears for WGN Radio. WGNRadio.com/Bears for all the information, including his podcast he does with Adam Johns from the Sun-Times. Adam, the one thing that's been texting a lot is about special teams. We've seen a mixed bag with special teams, but yesterday mostly negative, including two returns for touchdown, a shanked punt. This added to the negative already in our mouth, the taste in our mouth. And Marcus Cooper didn't run the field goal back when they beat the blocked field goal when they beat the Steelers. I mean, there seems to be something amiss with the Bears' special teams.
Well, I would categorize the first kick return for a touchdown by Bobby Rainey as sort of a fluke play. That I don't know if it's a special teams issue, but it sort of falls under these weird plays we've seen over the last 5 years where the Bears don't pick up a loose football.
Right.
Or
they don't touch
play
the guy when
the whistle.
He's down. Right.
Right. Now, I think that Josh Bellamy, I mean, he clearly hit Rainey's leg. What was unclear is whether or not that's what caused him to go to the ground.
Right.
And I actually agree with the decision that was made on the replay, which was not to overturn it because it wasn't clear. You were kind of guessing on whether or not that's what caused him to lose his balance because he immediately ran right into his own guy after that. So it was kind of a weird play. But I'll tell you what, Benny Cunningham was standing right there and could have touched him or finished
right.
the play. The whistle hadn't been blown. So that – I don't know if it's so much of a special teams issue on that play as it is, you know – it just not finishing, which goes back to coaching.
Yeah, it does. There's some weird thing there where they're just finished. That's a great thing you just said, and they're just not finishing, and you feel like that across the board.
Yeah. And then the other one, you know, I will say that that comes down to special teams. Some of it's coaching. The coaching aspect, I think, is more on the Ravens side. And what happened on the Bears side is more personnel. And I'll explain that to you. Look, every time someone gets hurt on defense, mainly on defense, but sometimes with offensive players too, like Benny Cunningham, it trickles down on the special teams. And eventually you get weaker and weaker and weaker. And sometimes we've seen that. Now, the Bears have better depth this year. And I think overall their special teams has been better. But in this game, they lost Sherrick McManus early, who's one of their two gunners.
Yeah.
And they lost Benny Cunningham a little bit later. Those were the two guys that you would usually have on the right side of your punt formation. And let's not forget John Harbaugh, the Ravens head coach, is a former special teams coordinator. And his teams are always well coached on special teams. And they ran a great play on that punt. They looked like they were going to sell out and go for the block. But instead, two guys ran out at Cravon LeBlanc, who was filling in for Sherrick McManus. Otherwise, he wouldn't have even been in that situation. So LeBlanc's not very experienced as a gunner, and they ran two guys at him and stuck him back near the line of scrimmage. I mean, when's the last time you saw a gunner stuck back at the line of scrimmage? That's what opened that whole left side up for the return. And so I have to give a lot of credit to the Ravens for pulling off a play like that. But sure, I guess you know, Jeff Rogers certainly has to go back to the drawing board this week and figure out how to avoid that, because he's probably not going to have Sherrick McManus this week.
All right, as we wrap up here, because we've got about 2 minutes left, the Chicago Bears get the win. They go to 2-4. We're starting to hear the rumbles, as we do every time around this year, that they still have a chance. They're still in it. Of course, Aaron Rodgers looks like he might be out for the year with the collarbone. Mm-hmm. The Packers lose. The Lions lose. The Vikings won, of course. But the 4-2 and 3-3, and then the Bears at 2-4. Is there optimism around this Bears team, this 2017 team, or are we firmly in the camp that this is a learning experience and this season is all about developing Mitch Trubisky? Forget the record.
Well, it can be both. First of all, what you just said is the most important thing. No question, developing Mitch Trubisky. He has to come out of this season better and in position to move on towards greatness starting in year two. But I want to touch back on something you said earlier in this hour, which was, and I think it maybe came from a texture that you referenced, but the Bears just don't know how to win.
Yeah.
That idea. That's exactly how I felt as this game went to overtime yesterday. They are just a team. It's part of turning over the culture, and they've done a lot of good things in that regard, but they have not figured out how to win close ball games.
You're right.
Especially on the road. We've seen it over and over and over and over again. They managed to pull it out yesterday. It didn't feel good, but they managed to pull it out. Okay, well, you have the Carolina Panthers coming to your building this week. Can you build on this? Can you turn this into two wins in a row? If they can do that, then I'll believe that they have started to figure out how to win close games, that they can actually win against decent teams, because they have two tough games coming up the next 2 weeks against the Panthers and the Saints. If they can pull out one of them, if they can win one of those games, you know, then maybe they have an outside shot at competing for the playoffs. I don't even like using that P word right now, but more importantly, just build on this win. If you can beat the Panthers and Cam Newton this week, then maybe you're actually building something, or maybe you're turning a corner as an organization.
There you go. Adam Hogue covers the Bears for WGN Radio. Find all of his great stuff at WGNRadio.com/Bears. He, of course, comes on with us for the Monday evening quarterback after the Bears play on Sunday. They play Sunday for the rest of the duration besides the bye. Adam, great to talk to you. Thanks for the insight.
Thanks, Justin.
Welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's not every day that we get a huge Broadway star in the studio and a huge Broadway hit on our off-loop stages. Fun Home is currently on stage at the Victory Gardens Theater in Lincoln Park. The Broadway musical won the Tony for Best Musical and Best Original Score back in 2015. That original score was co-created by my guest tonight, Janine Tesori. Tesori has been part of some of the best musicals ever produced, from Fun Home to Shrek the Musical to Thoroughly Modern Millie, just to name a very small sample size of her amazing career. Janine Tesori just did some events at the Victory Gardens, and she is in studio with us tonight at the big table. Janine, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure.
It is a pleasure to have you, and thanks for coming in. What does it mean to you to be in Chicago to get a chance to see your music on stage in a different theater?
Well, Chicago was the first tour stop that I had when I was 24, And I used to walk right by here, and I love this building. I've always loved this building. And I remember walking up and down Michigan thinking, I'm an associate conductor with Big River at what they were calling the Mistake on the Lake. I forget what. The Erie Crown. Was that right?
Right, Erie
and
Crown, yeah.
The Erie Crown. And I just thought, God, I've really hit the big time. I remember being so satisfied with myself. As you can see, it's low expectations.
Well, you finally got in the building. Here,
yes.
So that's good. You've been walking by for you.
That's true. After that's the security shakedown, I sure did.
To be able to see this show tour and be a part of just being able to see your music being done by different actors in different productions, does it have any sort of emotional value to you to see it being done over and over and over, to see it have lasting effect after its run, its beginnings on Off-Broadway?
Well, it's really important that it was in Chicago because Chicago is such a theater town. It's a really discerning audience, and it's an audience that understands theater in a different way. That's what I love. You know, people, artists make a living here. They have houses and things that I don't have in New York. I have, you know, I live in a postage stamp. And it's really wonderful. It's also the first time I ever saw a production of Fun Home that wasn't ours. And I'm not planning on seeing any more, but I really wanted to see it here at this theater. I really love JU, and I love the theater that I've seen in Chicago, so it was really important to me to come and literally see this for the first time in a way. I've seen this show probably 120,
wow.
No, 121 times, so, but this was quite different.
Is that tough for a composer to watch your show being done by and you're not involved in it?
Well, eventually I turn on my work. You know, I think that there's a point it's a little bit Madea-like, and I just think, oh, I just want to eat you. I just want to, you know, you should have been better. But I will say this work really stands, and I was so nervous about it, not for the production, but for my part in it. You really want to hand over something. Mm-hmm. It's basically a recipe, and it's like, you know, I wish that Martha Stewart had really tested those recipes when she put that together, because the souffle keeps falling. Oh, we forgot the, you know, there is a responsibility to setting something up. And I called Lisa Krohn immediately after I got back after seeing it and said, it's really there. It's there for anybody to do, you know, and if they're courageous enough, it's actually a very funny show. It's very heartbreaking, and it's all too real.
Yeah.
And so I'm really proud of it.
Do you have to resist the urge to tinker? Obviously, it's done, and it's on its way, but you've seen 121 times. Are there points where you're like, oh, that stanza, that part has always bothered me?
I will say, surprisingly, only with one show. A show called Violet was the first show that I made, and I didn't have the skills. The great thing about being old, and I'm old now, is that the ambition meets the skill. It doesn't mean that I can't make a fantastic flapperoo, as I call them, but I've really studied really hard, and so I know a lot more about musicals. And musicals to me they're somewhat oceanic. You know, my father was a doctor and a fisherman, which is a great combination. It's very biblical. And he used to say, you can't second guess either what the body can heal or what the ocean can do. You must always fear it. And he said a lot of people get very cocky around the water. They know it, and that's when they drown. That's when some things happen. You have to remember. And I think that about musicals in that way. And this one, there was no stone unturned. We worked on it for 7 years, and I just thought, I'm really done with it. And anymore, it's like that great quote in Six Degrees of Separation, you have to know when to take the art away, and then it's usually the right time.
And I want to get into the workshop process for all Broadway musicals. That seems to be the standard amount of time that goes into putting a show up. This show, Fun Home, Alison Bechdel's graphic novel. Talk about how you first came to this, and also what you found out of it when you read it and the idea of pulling your idea for a score out of it.
Lisa Krohn brought this project to me, and I didn't even know Lisa. It was an arranged marriage. And so there's that first moment where you know that you're going to be in a room drinking tons of coffee, usually bourbon, with this person for years and years. So that's partially that. Just think, can we make something together? We don't have to be friends, which we ended up being sister friends, but we have to make this thing together. And that really happened. Also, Alison waited a good 19 years before she wrote this book. She had to wait. She had to be of a certain age. And Alison and Lisa and I are very similar in age. We're the baby boomers. And we grew up where I remember Phil Donahue was so naughty to me. I could not believe what they were discussing on that. There was a time where things were not part of the national discussion. And it seems yet that even though we have greater than radio, you know, I can FaceTime with my daughter, but that doesn't mean that I'm listening or she's hearing me. Just the modes of communication might be vast, but it doesn't mean that they're effective. And I'm really struck with what a chord Fun Home and the lack of conversation, especially between parent and children, until it's too late. And so many people, we used to have a joke, it was called like the alley of the phone call, that people would leave the theater and call their parents.
Yeah.
And there would be all these people on their cell phone.
The telephone wire.
Right. All the things on set. And there would be, you know, calling their parents, telling them that they loved them. And was there anything they hadn't told them? And
so that resonated with you when you read the graphic novel that this was happening.
Immediately.
And for you to create music out of it, to say this is a musical, let's put this together. What was your thought? I can't put my brain to the idea of taking words that you see and being able to turn them into music. How did you transition from the emotion that was in the words to the music?
Someone once told me about New York apartments that as soon as you open the door when you're looking to rent or buy, that's the feeling you're always going to have every single time that you come home. So trust it. And that's how I feel about looking for something to musicalize. The first impulse, if you have to convince yourself it's a good idea, it's not a good idea for you. And as soon as I put down that book, I called her and I said, it's a fantastic idea. It's going to be really hard because I don't know how you make something that's nonlinear. I don't know how we're eventually going to do it. Like, I can't see it, but I can hear it.
Oh.
And that, you know, after a lot of coffee and a lot of bourbon and a lot of, we went all over the United States to so many retreats and workshops. We were the workshop queens. And it, because it took that long to say, what if, all of those what ifs. And then Sam Gold and the producers, when they came on board, they really understood that we needed an audience. We had something that I'll always do, a lab audience that paid, I think it was $10 or $15. And they saw a really early incarnation, but it wasn't reviewed. And the first thing that Sam did, he sort of, you know, rambled up there and he had a beer and a strange hat. And he said, look, you're going to leave this piece and you're going to say, God, they need a lot of work. And you're going to be right. I'm going to relieve you of that. Because there's so many times you see something and go, like, God, they have a real lot of work to do. But you're going to be correct. And that's what we're doing. And it was so joyous. It wasn't that it was easy, but it didn't invite that New York kind of what you got. That thing that I also sometimes do. You know, we can get very hard-boiled. And so that part of the process was one thing that really taught me. You can have a paying audience. Don't ask them to pay too much. Mm-hmm. And invite them in to be part of the process, not to tell you how to fix it, but to be there, you know, witnessing it while you're going on.
Well, for all the workshops that came out of it, it is obviously won the Tony, but it's also known in Broadway circles as one of the more ambitious and creative scores in Broadway history. And in studio with me tonight, Janine Tesori. She is the composer and co-composer and creator of Fun Home, which is the musical that's being produced at Victory Gardens Theater in Lincoln Park through November 12th. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation here at the Big Table with Janine Tesori. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, a longtime Broadway composer, Tony Award-winning composer, Janine Tesori. She's in town because Fun Home is on stage at the Victory Gardens running through November 12th. Before the break, we're talking about workshops. And you said this is sort of workshop to death, 7 years' time to put Fun Home, to get Fun Home to the Broadway stage, or to the off-Broadway stage to start, right?
Oh, yeah.
And when I hear that, I go, oh, so much time. And that is the standard.
Absolutely.
That is Broadway standard. Every actor and every director and composer that comes in here says that's how long it takes. Talk about that process. That's amazing to me of all the professional work that goes into a piece of theater before the audience even sees it.
I think it's like raising a kid. I just don't think you'd put your kid on Broadway when they were 9 months old. I mean, you could do it. Some parents would do it. It was like, get them out of a diaper. I don't care. It's probably I would do it. But, you know, you're raising a kid, and there is a process. You really want it to be around first grade, kindergarten or first grade, when it goes up on stage, and then it travels out. But they take a while because they have to take a while because you have to go away. This is my, I'd be so interested, but I know that Lin-Manuel shares this, and, you know, all of those shows, they just take time. You have to go away, and then you have to cast it with different people to make sure that you're not writing for that person specifically, which is really tricky because often I do. I love writing for specific people.
So you have
people to
change up the actors and the actresses because you don't want to get stuck in, and you're writing for one person.
Right. It's it's tricky, too. It would be like, the Versace putting all of the clothes on one model. You have a muse, and that's tricky because there are people I look to and they're muses for me. I want to write for them. However, theater really deals in metaphor, which means that as I go, you go. And that has to be anyone who can slip into that part. And sometimes it really is helpful to put someone in who is miscast because it should work anyway. And yet in the beginning stages, there's so many moving pieces, every key change, every piece of underscoring. I think it's why it's just like a Sudoku puzzle from hell where all the things that
it's
can move around.
It's constant work, right?
It's constant.
It's constant. If people think, okay, it's on stage and there's a lot of rehearsal that goes into that and it might take 2 or 3 years of your time, but this is a professional 9-to-5 type job that happens in weird workshop rooms in Manhattan and other places that look like an office conference room.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And much worse. I mean, yeah. When I think about the rehearsal spaces in New York, I mean, there's nothing glamorous. I have to remind myself to put on any kind of eyeliner when I go out in the morning and not look like, I'm available for any kind of yard work at any time, which I'm going to put yard work chic back into style back in. And, because it's really hard work. It's really lonely work. I love it. I wouldn't do anything else. I'm amazed at the power of music. I constantly study it. I'm trying to, I write a lot more opera now and works for orchestra. But I so admire when anybody does anything especially in the theater where it's a live event. You can't get a take and then put it in anything and save it. You can't. It's non-savable. It's based on something that's fleeting, just like our lives. That's what it is. It's about being available to the live thing. It's sports and theater, those two things. You can't, the Bulls don't know what's going to happen. They know what they think and what they want is going to happen. And theater is just like that, even though that they know on the page, those actors. The audience doesn't know, and the actor has to pretend. And there's nothing like it.
It really is something. And to think about all of the music that you've worked on, and I would assume, and I don't know this, but I would assume a lot of it that's not seen the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
Because the workshop process is one that you can go pretty far and it dies or it moves into something else, or like you said, people are replaced. Talk about that. Talk about the emotion around the acceptance and rejection and the idea that you're working on music and other things that may never see the light of day.
Theater to me is one of the great sports. It's a sport. And when people say, what was your best training for, besides the skills of learning all of that stuff, harmony and the piano, I say field hockey was the best thing for me. I was on teams all through high school. I didn't do one drama thing because you learn that you can't do it alone. And if you're going to do it alone, play tennis. And, just that idea that someone else, you have to pass the ball to someone. You have to, as well as they do, you do. And that is that's the idea of theater. It is something by committee that has hierarchy. It's a government. It's the way that things, it's messy, just like democracy. But it's also profound. It's a profound thing to be a part of. And that's one of the reasons that I really love it. You have to be tough, and you have to learn to let things go. I did a show called Caroline or Change with Tony Kushner, yeah, I collaborate with a lot, and he wrote a beautiful lyric called You'll Learn How to Lose Things. And that, I think a lot of people, including myself, I've had to learn to say, if it doesn't work, cut it. It's almost surgical. So I was pre-med, and that idea that everything, you're not going to say, oh, I was so attached to my appendix. It's like, well, it's not working. Cut it. It's very similar.
Gotta go, right?
Gotta go. It's the surgical precision, saying.
With all of that and the collaboration and even the competitive nature of professional theater, Broadway theater, the score that you produced for Fun Home was it was very creative, out of the box, in line with Hamilton and the way that it's changed Broadway. And how can you do that in the face of people saying, this is just a norm? The last 50 years, this is how people have, even yourself, you've written this way and this is how Broadway scores have been. To change it up, to try something different and know that you have to go through all of these different workshops and places where people could say, this is not on Broadway. How does that work for you to get through that process?
Such a good question. There's also a quote by George Kaufman that I really love. He said, don't make it different, make it good, that will be different enough, which is also, I just think about it all the time. I think it's the source material and being open to the parts of yourself that you haven't leaned into. It really is. Like, I work with Jake Gyllenhaal on Sunday in the Park, and we've worked together on a couple projects, and we'll continue to work together. And one of the reasons why I love him and I love working with him is he leans into spaces that are unknown to him but are there. And so when you go to see that he, you know, we just dropped the album for Sunday and Nightcrawler, he just released Stronger, you think, who is this man? Well, we're all very complicated people. Every single person I've ever met in my life has complications because they're human beings, unless they've been hatched. And even then,
even then,
they're just like complicated chickens. And I think the willingness to look at those places, I think there's a thing in our country that a lot of people don't really want to look there because they're afraid of it. Therefore, they start behaving badly or violently, or they try to kill what's the other, what's the different
thing. Have you ever
thing.
Had to push against your own self in the way that, that, yes, you want to do something different, you want to do something good, and you want to go there, but yourself is saying, maybe not that far?
Well, mostly to make a living. You know, I was a single parent for a really long time. And as a female in this business that's male-dominated, there was a point where, well, how am I going to pay in New York? And I've never done anything else but work in music. And I will not do anything else. That was something when I graduated that I just made a decision. I won't do it unless it's, you know, whatever. It has to be in music. That was the bar that I set. And so I think there is a point where you have to, I certainly had to think, oh, I have a portfolio within, right? So I have to do something that will provide and something that will nourish those things. And then eventually, hopefully, it will tip over, that that ratio changes. And it really has.
Janine Tesori is my guest. She's a Broadway composer, a Tony Award-winning Broadway composer, and she's my guest at the big table. Her show, Fun Home, is at Victory Gardens, running through November 12th. Janine, let's do this. Let's take a break, and we'll get an update on tonight's news. And we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Janine Tesori, Broadway star. That's what I'm going to call you. And I want to talk about that when we get back from the break. Janine Tesori in studio tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Janine Tesori. She's a longtime Broadway composer, Tony Award-winning composer. And the show she worked on, Fun Home, is at Victory Gardens Theater in Lincoln Park, running through November 12th.
I love the way you say Tony Award. Tony Award-winning.
Tony Award. That's not too many Tony Award winners that come through here. But it's on stage till the 12th. It won the Tony for, I mean, it won a slew of Tonys. But yeah. It was nominated for like gazillion, but also for original score back in 2015. And I kind of joked right before the news about you being a Broadway star. When I read that earlier, when I first said it at the beginning, you kind of scoffed a little bit. I saw you go, nah. But it is interesting that, and any other, if it's music, if it's TV, if it's film, the people behind the scenes who are doing scores and other things, they have a niche following. But if you are a composer, any sort of musician that's on a Broadway musical, the amount of the fandom, the loyalty, so many people come out, they love the Broadway scores. What is it about that? The fact that they might not even see the show, but they love what's coming out of what's being produced when it comes to the score and the music.
It's a really good question. I'm not sure. I wonder if it's maybe there's some, you know, intimacy, because a score has more of a transparency. It's also, even if they haven't seen it, those CDs are, you know, that they're produced in a way that they're not tracked, almost all of them. The new thing about the way that Hamilton was produced, it was so beautifully and so in such a beautifully contemporary way, the production. But most of them, you have 12 hours to do it, and it's soup to nuts. That was based on a really old rule. And you go in on the day off and you record it. And so it's like what happens in the theater. And I think that intimacy of an experience, you know that it's a day in the life of 12 hours of a show. And then you mix it and throw it around. And you know, all the things that we can do in the studio, certainly there's a lot more than what they used to do, which is literally play it down.
Right.
But at its heart, that's what it is. So it's very similar in the way that you hear it, that you see it.
You say you've always been into music. Why musicals? What was it about that form that grabbed you as a musician? What was it that drew you in and kept you?
I discovered them really late. As I said, I played teams, and I started the piano at 3. I played Edelweiss until my mother, I either had to start medication or get me lessons. And she did. And thank God, you know, and I just played all the classical literature, but I had a genius teacher who is no longer alive, and he told me that music, the musical language and fluency in, you know, I meet people sometimes and they have seven or eight languages, and I think, what is that like? It's the superpower. Whenever anyone asks me, what do you want your superpower to be? And I said, to speak any language. Because can you imagine? And he thought about music in the same way. Speak pop, speak rock, speak the way this is, understand this, and don't be a snob about it. You know, it doesn't mean that anything is better than that, even though I've been raised on classical music. We looked at bands, you know, we tried to understand all of that, and he was so wonderful that way. And so when people say your style is eclectic, it really is because I was schooled in that way to be able to ear train that way, not just in one style.
Does that give you more opportunity in Broadway because you have an eclectic background and people know that they may be taking on a project that might be in a different genre of music and they're like, Janine?
Yes. Yes. I was in Nashville for years. I produced in Nashville. I was behind the board at 24. My mentor met me and he said, you know, I've really never met anybody who has the same background, even though he was from Arkansas and I was from Long Island, and not even northern, you know, southern Long Island. I was from the north. And yet we formed a company, and we went all over the world making music, world music and country and gospel and classical. And, you know, I took that under, and he was really hard on me in the way that, you know, Russian taskmasters used to be on their ballet students, minus the hitting. It was really wonderful. He made me very tough to just say, don't take it personally. Yeah. If you're going to cry about something, don't cry about criticism. Cry about that thing that you have, you know, disappointed yourself. Forget about what other people say.
Actors and directors, and probably more actors, they have to toughen up at a certain point in their theatrical careers because reviews are harsh and, they're real. Is that the same for composers? Is it the same for arrangers, musicians?
Yeah, I've learned there are two ways to go, it seems to me, to ignore all of them or to read them. I read them now. Because I've decided I would read all of them at a certain point to see if there was something I could learn. What's useful? And after a while, there have been so many, you know, as many people said, talent free as talented. And I think, well, it must be somewhere in the middle. It doesn't even matter. Is there something useful about that comment? Is there? And especially there are a couple of people that I really follow. I don't read every single one because if it's going to be, again, helpful, especially when you're putting a piece together, I want to know.
Broadway as an industry is very competitive. Composers, as you mentioned, being one of the only women that does this work and highly decorated. Are you set for life in the way that you can get a project every time you want to get it back into musicals or you want to do something? You're doing opera, you said now. Are you at the point now that you have laid the foundation for your career and you have the ability to pick and choose what you want to do?
Yes and no. I'm really interested in other people's ideas, but I have a lot of ideas and always have. So I'm not dependent on the kindness of strangers anymore. I need to work to live. I'm certainly not set financially for life. But I really have a lot of things, and I love producing, and I love curating events. I was at City Center at the Encores Off Center for many years, and that really taught me something. And I think a lot of artists should switch. You do that in college, and because I didn't study theater until really late. I didn't have that, I stage managed this, and then I was a lighting designer. So I've tried to do that, and I think it's been really helpful. So I won't really ever be dependent on someone coming to me with something. But I love that, you know, because you'll think, I would never have thought of that myself, that idea.
On the success of Fun Home and Hamilton, two of the more creative musicals in our time, do you see new musicals coming up that are trying to push the boundaries or changing the way that musicals have been done in the past based on the success of shows like yours and Hamilton and others?
I think we're about to see a lot of people who have made decisions that musicals are really wonderful means of telling stories. I think there was a while where, I know when I worked in other places, in other cities, if people would say it's very musical theater and it was completely pejorative. And that's like my saying, that's very film. You know, it's really, you know, I would say key thing to say to someone. And now that's not really true because I think it's been elevated, certainly in the case of Hamilton and other people who have been doing that kind of work way before and laying the track for me, for Lin-Manuel, for everybody. There's a legacy. There's someone to look to. And I do think I hear many more people who want to write them, who are really challenged by them. They're hard. They're really hard
Absolutely.
To do.
Absolutely. Beyond the score, lyrics, and working with Lisa and Lisa Kronisch as well, to be able to tell a story so overtly. That's what I would, to have a hook, to be able to have great music, but to be able to tell the story in the music in a way that that's the story, I don't know how people do that.
I sort of think that about anything. It's so normal to me now that, you know, I'll be on the street and I'll hear something and I sort of hear them singing in a way where there wasn't music. But the truth is really that there's a tuning of the world that everybody can sing, you know, even everybody on the playground. Kids are born doing that, those kind of songs. So they're available to us, and I think it's our job to make the world realize that.
One of the great things about Fun Home was the kids that are in the show. When creating music with different ages, do you have to, as a composer, have to consider the subject work? And I know that's lyricists and there's other parts, but you have to think about who's actually putting this music that, like, you know, you're going to have a 10-year-old singing this as opposed to an adult or things of that nature?
You know, as a parent, I've been doing this for a really long time, and I started as a conductor. And I've had some great experiences with stage parents and some not great, really not great experiences. And I also think about that, because if I have kids in a show and I'm always, like, I've written so many parts for kids and I love working with them, but I'm always sort of, you know, ambivalent about it, because you think, God, they can, you know, on a Broadway show, they can save for their college and they can do so much. But it is a job, and it's odd for a 10-year-old, to have a job. The great thing about things like Fun Home and Matilda are if the experience is really watched over like it was in Matilda, and I think that our producers did an amazing job of it, it can be almost a school in that sense that there's a community because every kid has an understudy. And there's a way that they clump together and they have this great experience, especially if they don't stay too long. And Lisa and I sat down with all the parents before and said, if you feel like this is taking more than it's giving, you have to get them out, and we'll support you in that. Because it's otherwise you can really, you know, they're sponges, and you can dent their experience of being in a show. And we really wanted it to be great. And that was true on the tour, and it was true on Broadway.
All right, my last question as a musician, and you mentioned that you can tune the world or tune around and you...
Well, it's sort of like radio. If you really adjust the dial and you focus in on it, it's really available to anybody. Can do what I do. I just can't do anything else, honestly.
You are a celebrated musician. You've won awards, all slew, including the Tony for Fun Home. Does it change music that you created? I listen to music. I'm not a musician. I'm like, oh, this means so much to me. Is that the same emotion, the same feeling to you as a musician, someone who's spent their and dedicated their entire adult life to the craft?
I can't really describe what music is like for me, because it's like an endless source of things that I don't know how to do yet. It's one of the reasons I don't see musicals too much, is I rarely can relax into watching them, because my ear can't stop working. Even in films, I love seeing plays because I can really just give over to it. But even in film, you know, a music cue will come up and I think, oh, great use of this. Oh, that, I wonder, how did they, you know, that's click, 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 and suddenly you're in your head. And in a play, you
right.
just, but I love going to see, I just went to see Pina Bausch at BAM. And the way that she made work, the way that she composed work, was just, it really got my brain and my soul going. But that's true for certain books, The Jazz of Physics, I just read, and there are other things that you just think, oh, what if you, oh, that, and just, you know, in the spaces, I think it gets everything going so that when your spaces, when you're brushing your teeth, something will just bubble up and think, oh, I could do that. That's a way.
There's no guilty pleasure pop song where you're like, I don't care how this was produced. I love it.
Okay. Well, if I heard Despacito one more time. My daughter, when she first, I mean, she loves, that's the other thing is I live through her with all of this. She's like, you've got to listen to this. And the tracks are so amazing. But I grew up in an era where, you know, Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Cat Stevens and the way, especially Blood, Sweat, and Tears, the way that they used brass. Like, I love those arrangements. Those arrangements are so beautiful. Joni Mitchell and The Who, those arrangements are so, man, they can be done by the people who are doing them. They're not filled with a tremendous amount of overdubs. So the live performance and the studio performance have a relationship. And, of course, you know, you can sit down and keyboard anything. I love a good keyboard part, but my heart is really with that.
Janine Tesori, the Broadway Tony Award-winning composer and musician. She's done so many different musicals, including Fun Home, which is at the Victory Gardens Theater in Lincoln Park, running through November 12th. Janine, a total pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being my guest tonight at the Big Table.
Completely. I'm in love with the Big Table.
You know, I got a text, Pete, 708, said, do you not do the Republican and Democrat arguing with each other anymore on Mondays? Of course we do. Touche. I forgot to mention at the top of the show, it's usually a Touche Monday. Roebling and Lundy are in studio for a slug it out boxing match, but instead of their hands, they use their words. They have the night off. Dave was out of town. We were working it out. I said, you know what? You guys, on me. Take this one off. They'll be back next Monday. I forgot. You know, it's funny. Like, you forget that we've been doing, we'll do regular segments on the show. We'll do something where we stick at, just like Studio 435 coming up or whatever. And sometimes when we don't do that, it's funny because I forget to tell people we're not doing it. Because I made that call, I think it was Friday, where I'm like, well, you know what? Let's just take it off. It's going to be too much to complain, you know, replace everybody. And then I don't let the listeners know.
Every Friday night, we get a bunch of texts looking for Steve Gadlin.
That's right, in the frying pan. Right. Steve will be back.
Yeah.
I should mention that, too, to all of his loyal fans. He will be back coming up here in, I guess we'll call it season 8 of the frying pan coming up. He will be up once the Preps Plus Chicago, when high school football runs its course and we get some champs. Once we get to the champs stage, then frying pan comes back. All right. Coming back, Studio 435. Stay with us. All right. Thank you very much, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman. Well, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here in our Allstate Showcase studio. Beautiful Michigan Avenue. And tonight, it's a real treat. Actually, as I said, this might be why we do Studio 435 in the first place. Chicago has such great musicians that work together. They collaborate. They start up new projects. And that's at the heart of Sunshine Boys. You've got three great musicians that make up Sunshine Boys. You got Dog Julens, who played with Poi Dog Pondering. Jackie Schimmel, who played with Justin Roberts, among others. And you have Frieda Love Smith, the famed drummer of iconic indie rock bands like the Blake Babies and Antenna, just to name a few. The trio Sunshine Boys are recording new music, and they are on stage this Thursday night at Martyrs in Lakeview. Dag, Jackie, Frieda, welcome to Studio 435. And you know what? Let's get right into it. We're ready to rock. So why don't we hear the track Billy Boy? Here they are, Sunshine Boys.
Like the streetlights are coming on, Billy Boy. And it's time that you were heading back home, Billy Boy. They'll be calling your name out soon, telling you it's time to come and clean your room. There'll be no more sleeping in until noon, Billy Boy. You are headed for another world now. For another world. Oh, Billy Boy,
another surprise. Another place that you don't recognize. Don't worry though, it only lasts a lifetime or so. There you go. Don't your home seem so far away, Billy boy? About 100 years since graduation day, Billy boy. How can a bright sun burn so cold? How can a young man feel so old? He's hoping for a hand to hold, Billy boy.
All right. Thank you. Sunshine Boys in studio. That's Doc Julin, Jackie Schimmel, Frieda Love Smith. They're going to be playing at Martyrs coming up this Thursday night in Lakeview. Dag, Jackie, Frieda in studio tonight. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break with Pete. We'll get the band up on the microphones here. We'll do a little chatting, and then we'll hear some more live music from Sunshine Boys. I'm very excited to talk about not just, of course, the super group put together, but the music that they're working on, a new album. Here, Studio 435, Sunshine Boys, stay with us. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music in Chicago. Tonight, no exception, Sunshine Boys in studio. They're super group. Of some great musicians in Chicago that have impressive resumes. Doc Julin, Boy Dog Pondering, Jackie Schimmel, Justin Roberts Band, of course, Frieda Love Smith, The Blake Babies, Antenna, Mysteries of Life, and on and on and on. Great to have you guys in studio. This is awesome. But the band that we're talking about tonight, Sunshine Boys, which has songs that are out now, but you guys are working on some new music, blue music.
Well, right. Our debut album is being mixed now. We've done all the recording for it. It's called Blue Music, named after one of the songs on the record. And we're hoping this all comes together with the final mixes arriving sometime, you know, throughout the month.
And there's a Pledge Music campaign, which I want to get to because I've had a lot of musicians that have on it. You guys have all gone through record companies and record labels. You understand how the game is played, especially when it comes to the music industry. So we'll talk about why you want to do it differently this time around. But pledgemusic.com/sunshineboys. is where you can find out more information about the album.
Yeah.
So how did this come about? I mean, you've all known each other, right? But what happens to the event to say, why we know each other, why don't we play music together?
Well, we were asked by some friends of ours to sort of fill out their band for a one-off show. And as soon as we started playing together, we realized we should be our own band. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys are fine, but we should be our own separate band. And we just immediately clicked.
Yeah. And then the songs just sort of started coming, and we a great thing for any writer or anything is a deadline, and we had a deadline of an opening gig that we were offered, and so we sort of went immediately into writing and practicing mode, and we learned a lot of material, and so that was kind of the thing to kind of get us really in motion was you know, learning songs for a gig. And
what I love about all three of your work is that you've had success in your respective bands, but they're different sounds. mean, Poi Dog is different than what you were doing with Mysteries of Life, or Justin Roberts is much different than Blake Babies. So when you come together as a supergroup and the three of you come in to start working together, you like that term, right?
That's what we use, obviously.
Yeah, right, obviously. But when you come together to create something where you all have, you've had backgrounds in different types of sound, how do you get on the same page of what this band sounds going to be?
I do think there are pretty striking aesthetic differences from all the things we've done, but we really share a work ethic and an attitude, and also just our personalities clicked so quickly that we were able to collaborate, and that there was something kind of magical about the different approaches that we all brought to it, that maybe it shouldn't have worked on paper necessarily. I feel like I'm a punk drummer and Dog's a little prog compared to like what I've played. And Jackie has this amazing background in music school, like a really like a musical mind. But it works really well.
Is that the key? I mean, you've all been in different bands. I mean, is that usually how it comes together? Is it about gelling personality wise before you actually even get to
I think that was a big thing for us, was the personalities. And I knew that the three of us would get along. I knew that our you know, and I felt that our individual sound stylistically, how we played, I felt that they were really going to kind of work very well together. I kind of write these sort of jangly guitar things, and Jackie has a super melodic yet very, you know, rhythmically on top of things kind of playing, and Frida's drumming has a kind of a this driving, you know, it's a driving force that kind of still swings, you know. It's not just a robotic hypnotic thing, but it's got real feeling and swing to it. So it's just everything from the first kind of songs that we started doing, like it just seemed to kind of highlight all of our individual strengths into a what I felt was a really immediately strong sound.
And I think you called it, like you kind of heard it in your head.
Yeah.
Before I could, but you were really right when you envisioned the three of us together.
Yeah.
The
other group that we were asked to help out, they asked Frida and they asked me, and then they had another bass player in mind that was not able to do it, and I just said, I know this is your project, but you have to trust me on this. It's got to be Jackie. And they were like, okay, fine. And in came Jackie. And then it was like, then the three of us, as we were working, like, all right, this is our own kind of thing here.
For all three of you being accomplished, how familiar are you with each other's work? I mean, you obviously can hear each other on different stuff, and the bands, Poi Dog is, I mean, it's such a famed band here in Chicago, but how familiar? Because you said, you know, I bring the jangly guitar and you know, all the other kind of styles and disciplines. Are you already familiar with that because of knowing the person, but also knowing the person's work?
Yes. Jackie and I played together for a long time when I was kind of working on a solo, you know, thing 15 years ago or something like that. So Jackie and I played together a lot. She recorded on an album I did. I was a huge fan of the Blake Babies. As soon as I was working at a record store and the promo copy of Earwig came in, and I just put it on and I was like, oh my God, this is great. You know, I just loved the whole thing. I loved the songs. I loved the way everybody played. And so I was very familiar with their work. And Jackie and I, like I said, have played together for a long time.
So. And fun fact, the Slugs, Dog's band, the Slugs played with the Blake Babies at Lounge Acts in 1990,
I think
it was.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a small world.
It's a small world. And I think the band name comes from a conversation that we had a long time ago about all the different clubs that we played, all the different people that we know, and it was just reminded me of the scene in the Sunshine Boys where they're arguing about all the theaters they played, you know, and having disagreements. So it's just sort of, I don't know, just, and it seemed kind of fun to have a band called Boys when two-thirds of the band were women, so they accepted it right away.
When you guys are going after putting a whole album out, and we'll talk about that whole process with Pledge Music, but when you're determining to put out that kind of effort, that output creatively, and you just started as a band, what are some of the processes, what's the process to go through, what are some of the positives, but what are some of the challenges? Is you three are all accomplished in different ways, you've worked with other musicians, you have your own ways of doing things, how do you come together as a trio to record something that is this band, you know what I mean, that is different than the stuff that you've done in the past?
Well, I always find it very helpful when the songwriter, and Dog has written all the songs, you know, he makes a demo and sends it to us.
Right.
And I think when we come together to rehearse it, we've all put our own sort of spin on it, and I'm sure I come up with bass parts that he didn't even imagine, and Frida comes up with drum things that we didn't even imagine, and then as we're playing together, he starts doing different guitar things and different vocal things than he had on the demo, and mm-hmm. it's just been a real natural sort of process.
Yeah,
it has.
I think there's also a factor of it that we just don't have time to screw around, you know?
Like, we're old people.
And so when it comes time to rehearse, believe me, I've been in a lot of bands and I've been in a lot of situations where the first 90 minutes of rehearsal yep. is drinking bourbon. Right. And that's fine, you know, but when we get together, we're there to work, and these guys come in, as Jackie mentioned, with amazing parts, and it's just a very kind of diplomatic process. And so the whole thing, just sort of the songs kept coming. We had a few gigs, and we realized that it was, you know, we wanted to work towards an album, you know. As outdated as that concept is, let's record an album and put it out.
Well, you know? I mean, it's such a collaborative city, and I hear this all the time. People come in and they talk about the different musicians that you're able to play with. Do you guys feel that too? Do you feel as esteemed musicians in this town that it is easy to go to somebody who has had a track record and be like, hey, we should play music together?
I feel I've been through that kind of situation before. There was definitely a time when that was more of a thing happening, and I think that's another thing that we used to do together, the Hoot Night series,
right.
Where just a collaborative, fun, concept-based night of, you know, two weird artists slammed together, and, you know, you'd pair off or form little groups, and I always, you know, that was really cool. That was a real growing experience for me as a musician, is to play with other people
right.
and things like that now, but I'm really happy to be in such a collaborative and productive group environment right now.
And it's fun to be in a trio too, because
yeah.
like there's just one of each instrument, so you get to be, you know, spread out and do more stuff than you might ordinarily do if there's like five of you in a band,
right?
You know,
yep.
so.
It's Econo.
Yeah,
Frida,
yeah.
you've had a lot of experience with the Econo. I mean, that's just how the Blake Babies and 10 all the bands. But I think Dog, I think of Poi Dog Pondering, and there's a lot going on. Even Justin Roberts, the band, I mean, there's a lot going
yeah.
on in that band. Do you see, as musicians, is it easier to pare down and get to brass tacks
well,
and do the trio?
Being in Poi Dog is a learning thing, in that you have to know when to just not play, or just to be, you know, just to back off. You know, I was used to coming from the Slugs, which was like, all right, guys, all four of us play as loud as, you know, as possible,
right.
and I'll meet you at the end of the song. But Poi Dog was more of a lesson in pulling back and learning that type of musicianship. So that was very helpful in that regard. But what we have going now, I don't know if there's no overplaying. There's really no guitar solos, which is like, you know, kind of a, you know, every
right.
guitarist really wants to set himself up for the big, put the foot on the monitor.
Right, right.
You know.
A lot of pedals.
Right, sure, yeah. No,
yeah,
it's
sure.
it's really more just about the songs and what happens when the three of us play.
Yeah.
So,
Sunshine Boys in studio tonight. Doc Julin, we have Jackie Schimmel, Frida Love Smith. All, of course, playing in their respective bands. Jackie with Justin Roberts, Frida with Blake Babies and so many others, Dog with Poi Dog Pondering. I mean, you've all worked in so many different bands. Those are just the sort of headliners. But the album is coming out. It's called Blue Music. It is being self-financed or is being done by crowdsourcing, pledgemusic.com/sunshineboys. And we'll talk about that in the second half here. Studio 435, Sunshine Boys are going to play some more music coming up here
yep.
after the news. They are going to be playing as well at Martyrs on Thursday night. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll get Rob's news, and we'll get more live music here in Studio 435 with the Sunshine Boys. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in Studio 435. This is, of course, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Tonight, Sunshine Boys. This is the super group. They love it. Dog Julin has played with Poi Dog Pondering, Jackie Schimmel with Justin Roberts, and Frida Love Smith with the Blake Babies. The trio, of course, recording new music, and they're on stage this Thursday night at Martyrs, right there on Lincoln Avenue in Lakeview. This is the album that's coming out is called Blue Music, and they've got a crowdsource at Pledge Music. We're going to talk about after we hear some live music tonight here on 720 WGN. Here they are, Sunshine Boys with the track Schoolyard Bully. Take it away, guys. Sunshine Boys in studio. That is, of course, Doc Julin, Jackie Schimmel, Frieda Love Smith. Come on up to the table here, guys.
Thank you.
Their album coming out, Blue Music, which is right now we're going to talk about that. PledgeMusic.com/Sunshine Boys. They're going to be at Martyrs coming up here on Thursday night. Martyrs in Lakeview. But the band Sunshine Boys in studio 435 tonight. That was the track Schoolyard Bully. Let's talk about, I mean, you have. All three of you have recorded. You've been part of the quote-unquote music industry. There, I've had a lot of conversations with artists who have said that this is this day and age in 2017, as there has been sort of a collapse of the music industry, is actually great for artists in the sense that you can go right to your fans to get people to essentially fund the work that you want to do. Talk about that.
I like that direct access to listeners, that kind of feeling of control. And it's also kind of a relief to not blame the record label for everything, mm-hmm. just to kind of be responsible for how well things are going. And yeah, just like that sense of control is, it's really welcome. I've worked with major labels and small labels, and it's kind of nice to just remove that whole layer.
Right.
Yeah, it works in that it's like it's a pre-order situation. So
right.
we've got a number of people who are, you know, friends of ours, people who are friends of our other bands, you know, fans and stuff like that. And it's just great because it's like it's not just we're asking necessarily just for money, but, you know, we're
right.
offering it's like a chance to pre-order. And it's really been just very helpful.
It's almost too good
right.
in the sense that you're right. It is. I mean, the idea that you can go directly to a fan base that all of you have been cultivating over time. There is something great about that, and so many artists talk about that. Obviously, not having a label and support and some of the variables that could be, you know, when it comes to support from a music industry is a challenge without it. But the idea of going straight to it, I mean, there is something really freeing about that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, and also try getting paid by a record company. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's, it's not going
to
happen.
Right, yeah. So...
Yeah, finding a way to sort of reach out to your fans and get them to sort of subsidize the creation of the record, and then you already know there's 10 people, 15 people, 50 people who actually want the record, and they get to have it because they've already paid you for
it.
And
they're
before
involved
it even
in
exists.
The process. Yeah.
I mean, there's this vested interest.
Right.
I always, and you great musicians to ask this question, but do you think that this is the future of music as we know it? I mean, are we going to see more large corporations and larger bands and people who don't necessarily need to do a pledge music, but like a U2 or bands like that go, hey, man, you know what? Just pay us what would be the cost. We'll create it for you. I mean, you see that as possibly the future of music?
I see it right now on Pledge Music, because when I go on there, it automatically like searches all the artists on my iPhone and shows me projects by all of them. And I'm like going, wow, they seem a little large to need this.
Right. It's like everyone you listen to is on there.
And it's both the recognition that you are losing money if people are only listening to you on Spotify or streaming sites, and also that outreach to your fans. I mean, one of the best things about Pledge Music, because Justin did this for his most recent record as well, is it's not just, hey, you can get some CDs or a t-shirt or something like that. There's all these experiences that you can have. Like some people,
you can be creative in what
exactly,
you actually
like
want to
give.
You can
have like a reward of handwritten lyrics or you know, hey, you can come be backstage before a concert. So it's a much more sort of outreach to the fans and allowing the fans to experience more of what it's like to be in the band. That I think is so
why do you,
great.
Doug, what do you need a record label for then? I mean, what would be the reason that the music industry, as it's been traditionally known, would continue to exist if the artist is getting the opportunity to go direct to the consumer?
Right. Yeah, it's a very good question. I think we would lean on a record label for promotional aspects of the band. You know, trying to get you known or trying to get you to a radio station or things like that. But I guess you know.
Your big record label got us to put you guys on.
Yeah, so I guess we don't really need them. Someone's gonna have to break the news to them.
Yeah,
but it is. It kind of ties in with another thing that's happening. There are a lot of people hosting house concerts and things like that. And people are, you know, established artists are going out on the road and they're booking these things themselves. And there you can get people, your friends to. You know, get 30 friends in your living room. Everybody brings a covered dish, and they, you know, it's a great chance. People sell their merch, and it's really a very there's no walls between the artist and
the spirit of those shows. And again, a lot of artists that come through talk about it. Even the younger artists talk about house show circuits, where they don't even play. They avoid even playing. They won't even play the big places that you usually would see a band, like Metro, things like that. They actually are on circuits in Chicago of house parties that kids show up to, but. What I love about it, I think about the Blake Babies is, and our conversations that we've had when you came in with the book or even with the band, is early on, that was what you would do. You'd go town to town with an album, and you would have 15, 20, 30, and every time you came back, more people would come out. It seems like the spirit of that, which is really what a band was, the recipe to make a band successful, is honored through Pledge Music, but also through these house shows.
Definitely, that DIY punk ethic, it seems like, has just come back. Around and there is something really direct about it, and the money goes straight into the artist's pocket instead of getting filtered through the venue. And by the way, one of our pledge items is we will come cook dinner at your house and play music.
Right. Yeah. Yep.
So I don't think a record label can really compare with that.
No,
they're not.
I mean, they might send over a couple of bad pizzas or something like that. But we're going to come.
Best. We're
going to cook.
We're slicing for you.
Yes.
Exactly.
How is Chicago as a town for you guys? I mean, for as the artist, and you've had projects, and Poi Dog is a great example of a band that, I mean, this is considered an iconic Chicago band.
Yeah.
How is Chicago for you guys as you're professional musicians, but you look to make a living and continue to make a living off your music? Is Chicago supportive? Is it a positive music environment?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think
it's great.
I think there are plenty of people making their, you know, living doing music. I've seen a lot of great players who, you know, they work as jobbers, they'll play weddings and stuff like that. And I don't know if, you know, the scene like downtown here is probably was a time when you could go along Michigan Avenue and find 50 jazz clubs, you know, each with five musicians on the bandstand each of them, you know, making their living. I don't think that that thing is really happening so much anymore, but I've certainly been lucky and to be in Poi Dog. That's been a band that's never had any problems, you know, for a while, doing well at a show and things like that. So,
and they're supportive.
Well, there's so many different kinds of venues in town. That's what's so great about it. Like, I mean, you can play a big room, like you guys have played the Vic and stuff like that. But then 2 weeks ago, we played in some people's barn behind their house.
Right,
and
yeah.
And those are both totally awesome venues to play in.
Completely, yeah.
People come to shows in Chicago still. It was true back in the late 80s and early 90s when I first started touring. You could count on people turning up. No matter the weather, and it's still the case. People support music. People love music here.
Yeah, and shows are still reasonably priced in Chicago, unlike some other cities.
What I've always liked about it, and again, just from my in this chair talking to different musicians that come through, it feels like you'll have these home bases, and I've noticed that more through places like Martyrs is a good example, but Hideout's another one, Space up in Evanston, where there just seems to be a culture and a community that surrounds the stage. It's not necessarily, you know, the way it always has been, where people come out and be like, I gotta follow Dag, I gotta go wherever he's at. Now there's almost like this community that'll come out to that stage on a Monday night. They know there's going to be a great band there.
Yeah, I think the Hideout is definitely a great example of that. I think people just appreciate the attitude of the folks who own and run that place and their commitment to quality and everything like that. And I think people just probably have a real allegiance to the place in general, no matter who is playing.
Yeah, you can trust that they're going to curate who they book very, very well. So that you know, even if you've never heard of that artist, it's probably going to be a good show.
Yeah.
Sunshine Boys in studio tonight. Dag Juhlin, Jackie Schimmel, Frida Love Smith. All right, we'll do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll get our last song. Sunshine Boys playing this Thursday night at Martyrs in Lakeview. And they also have their new album, Blue Music, which is being mixed as we speak.
Hopefully at this moment.
PledgeMusic.com/Sunshine Boys if you want to get the album, support the band, Sunshine Boys. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. One last track here, Studio 435. Stay with us. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435 tonight. This is great. Sunshine Boys. It's been so great to talk with such great Chicago acclaimed musicians. Dag Juhlin, who's played with Poi Dog Pondering. Jackie Schimmel, played with Justin Roberts. Frida Love Smith, one of my favorites of all time. No doubt about it. Blake Babies, Antenna. I'm telling you. Now you're just going to take me right down memory lane, you guys. I'm going to get all the records now. I'm going to get all your stuff out. Sunshine Boys will be on stage at Martyrs this Thursday night, 3855 North Lincoln Avenue. They're going to be at Martyrs. They also got a new album coming out, Blue Music, pledgemusic.com/Sunshine Boys to get more information about that and their crowdsourcing. All right, so we're going to get one more song tonight. This song is called Tripping Through Time.
Correct.
All right, you guys ready?
Yep.
Take it away.
Thank you. One, two. And someone steps into the frame. There is no need to know the name. From then on, nothing is the same. Just the universe to blame. And someone's dancing in a dress. Someone's mind is such a mess. The future's anybody's guess. Still, the only word is yes. And I believe. You can fly, and with no effort winging by, soaring when you don't ask why, crashing when you start to try. And I believe that I'm a tripping through time. I believe that I'm a tripping through time.
little town. Gold from green to gold to brown. And as the summer simmers down, a September school bell sounds. Little family, they're singing Beatles by the sea. I look again now, could it be the middle one is me? And I believe that I'm tripping.
Sunshine Boys in studio 435 tonight. Yes, they'll be playing at Martyrs on Thursday night, 3855 North Lincoln Avenue. The new album is called Blue Music. It's at pledgemusic.com/sunshineboys. Sunshine Boys is the super group. I'm glad they're in studio. Doc Julin with Poi Dog Pondering. And I should mention, on loan from Steve Dahl.
Thank you very much.
Just I didn't want to get you in, I didn't want to get you in trouble, right, okay, for being on a different radio much. Station. I did hear rumors you were taking over for Kathy on Eric and Kathy, but
I was really in talks to become the new Kathy.
You were,
really.
I know.
Not the new Eric.
Not the new Kathy. Eric, right? Also, Jackie Schimmel, bass player who plays with Justin Roberts, among others, and Frieda Love Smith, one of my favorite musicians from the Blake Babies and Antenna. I can't thank you guys enough for coming in. So it means a lot to have you guys here. Really appreciate it.
Likewise,
thanks for playing.
Thank you.
We are very welcome.